Welcome to Friends of Amandla, The Power Within, a special four-part series that explores the authentic stories and lessons from those closest to me, my personal friends. Over these episodes, we'll dive deep into their journeys, struggles, triumphs, and the wisdom they've gathered along the way. This isn't just about their accomplishments, but about the human experiences that shape us all, the mistakes we learn from, the challenges we overcome, and the incredible power of community. A strong tribe can uplift, inspire, and propel us forward, reminding us that every life holds a lesson. And sometimes, the greatest lessons come from the people we know and trust. Welcome to another episode of Amandla with myself and Bill. And as part of the Friends of Amandla series, I've got another tribeswoman of mine that I'd love for you to meet. I want you to meet Lebo. My friend Lebo is my spirit animal. She is adventurous, funny, determined, and seems to manage to do a million things all at once with an enviable amount of energy. She travels a hell of a lot, loves a good time, is truly one of the most generous people I know, and someone who can talk intelligently about almost any topic under the sun. Just bring up a topic with Lebo, she's probably going to talk about it. She's my friend who is both interested and interesting, smart, gilly lady, gilly panzola, founder and CEO of Advent Group, just a lover of life, and has taught me so much about resilience, keeping the main thing, being honest with yourself, and giving yourself enough doses of grace to keep moving forward one day at a time, one foot in front of the other. I love her so much. Welcome, my friend.
Wow. You're really invited to my funeral, Chomi. That right there. Sheesh, I don't think I've ever heard myself described like that.
Really?
Sheesh, thanks, friend.
I'm so honored to have you here with me. And I'm glad that you agreed, because I think out of everyone that I asked, when are you the least willing?
Really? You were like, oh no. You want me to talk about what? Me? I ain't gay. Okay.
But you agreed, so thank you.
Yeah, see, I love you that much, friend.
Thank you, friend.
I'm prepared to put myself out there somewhat.
Thank
you. Although I suppose people that know me are probably going to say, ooh, she's lying. That one, any opportunity she's here talking.
You know, we'll keep it cute.
Okay.
We'll keep the main thing.
100%.
Keep the main thing. So why did I want to share all the lessons that I've learned from you with others, I think, is just around resilience. I think there is a lot of resilience that I've learned just from life-lifing. But I think having you in my world has allowed me to often keep the main thing the main thing. Like, you're the friend that I call when I want to be talked off the ledge of overthinking, because I think that that's something that we all have, because we're all like sort of like perfectionists.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I know that a lot of that, from my observation of you, has come from your journey as an entrepreneur, your journey having gone through a divorce and seen the other side of it, your journey of raising kids who are talented. And so it just requires resilience on all fronts. I'm sure you would also describe yourself as resilient.
Oh, no, 100%.
Now, in hindsight, right?
Yeah.
But where do you think where does it come from? Like, where do you think it began?
I think it's just the people that I'm from, right?
Mm.
And I don't want to make it as a comparison to kind of anybody else, because I think childhood is something to survive, really. I say it to my kids all the time.
So just survive it.
Like, just get through it. It's you are growing. There's so much going on. There's hormones. So it's just something to survive. But I mean, speaking just for myself, like in terms of just how I grew up, my family we're a very small family. There's kind of my sister, my brother, and my parents, and it was always just the five of us, and my parents were in business. And my siblings then went off to university and school, and I was to boarding school, and I was in essence the only kid left at home. So, you know, grew up very much like an only child, with two parents that pretty much worked 16 hours to 24 hours a day. I think there were points where my parents used to interchange, where my dad would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, go open the shop, and my mom would then leave at 7 o'clock in the morning to go relieve him, come back at 2 o'clock in the afternoon after he's done taking a nap. And literally that was their lives the entire time.
That's wild.
So I spent a lot of time alone, like a lot of time alone. Mm. As a result, there's a lot of things that one will experience as a child where, you know, if I look at my own kids, I'm kind of constantly there to catch them as they fall.
Mm.
And as a result, there's a lot of things that they really don't need to become resilient about.
Gotcha.
Whereas I feel like for me, I just kind of had to get up and get it done.
Mm.
I remember
so
the first time,
hyper-dependence happened.
Oh, no, 100%. 100%. And I mean, I remember I was telling a friend of mine a story about how there was a point in time where I remember being home like completely alone.
Mm.
And I used to have to get home and think, okay, what am I going to have for dinner? And the only thing I knew how to make was custard. So,
did you make the custard or did you pour it out of the Ultramel box?
No, we didn't have Ultramel box. I know
back then
Ultramel
right.
was like such a luxury, right?
Yes.
So we used to have like the custard powder with
yes,
milk.
Yes, yes.
That was the only thing I knew how to make. So for like at least there was proper like a month where I had custard for dinner every single night.
Mm.
And the only time I would eat would be like at school, like at the tuck shop.
Mm.
And even then, you'd kind of eating chips. And so, yeah, my partner, let's call him my husband for lack of a better word.
Mm.
He always sits there and he's like, you know, you literally raised yourself. I'm like, yeah, kind of low key.
I did.
Yeah.
So that brings up an interesting question for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a factor of the country that we live in.
Yeah.
Either are interested in going into entrepreneurship or have to go into entrepreneurship because there's no other way. And so I'm not even talking about early start entrepreneurs, or maybe it is even people who are just thinking about it.
Mm.
Is let's look at it in the context of your experiences, exactly like you're saying, it feeling a little bit isolating.
Yep.
What do you think entrepreneurs now, because you are an entrepreneur, raising children very differently to the way that you were raised. Like, what are some of the, let's say, the things that people underestimate about the impact that entrepreneurship has on your family life, even before we talk about what are some of the things you need to consider about being an entrepreneur, period, because I know you've got some strong feelings about that. But what do you need to consider when you're going into entrepreneurship, or even if you're an entrepreneur now and maybe haven't truly thought about the impact it's having on your family life?
I mean, I think ultimately it comes with pros and cons, right?
Mm.
I think for me, it was never an option. It was always a calling.
Mm.
It never felt like something I chose. It felt like something that chose me.
Mm.
I specifically remember being clear on the fact that I want to work for myself. And I actually remember describing it to somebody and saying, this is back then when I was in my early 20s. And they said to me, what do you want to do?
Mm.
And I said to them, I want to sell stuff. And they were like, what do you mean, sell stuff? And I was like, I don't know, man. I'm going to sell anything.
Mm.
Man, even if I have to sell people, I'm going to sell something. Because I just knew I wanted to be in a sales space. And I guess maybe for me, that was all that I knew. That was,
yes,
you know, all that I grew up with. Having grown up behind my parents till, and then gone on to like my mom's restaurant and my dad's bottle store. And that was all I was ever exposed to.
Mm.
But you know, you go into, and even going into university, I remember going to university thinking, I'm forced to go to university. My dad made it a absolute non-negotiable.
Mm.
You're going to varsity, you're going to get a degree. It's not even a discussion. And I remember thinking, what do I want to study? And I was like, I want to study something as general as possible. Like, I want to dabble in a little bit of everything.
Mm.
So, did a little bit of economics, a little bit of statistics, a little bit of kind of all of that. But you know, ultimately, when you then kind of get into the process of saying, I want to start a business, I mean, I sometimes feel like describing it as an entrepreneur makes it seem so, wow, there's something like quite big about it.
Mm.
But I mean, the lady that sells, that repackages a giant packet of knickknacks into little packets.
Is an entrepreneur.
An entrepreneur, 100%.
Yes.
Who sits on the side of the road, the guy who bakes muffins in his house and goes and sells them at the taxi rank is an entrepreneur.
Mm.
It's just the bigness of the word and the way it's become such a buzzword has made it seem like you're not an entrepreneur unless you're doing something really huge, or you're making a lot of money, or it has to be something so like otherworldly. It has to be a rocket to Mars or Tesla, electronic cars. It has to be something really big in order for you to be considered an entrepreneur. Whereas actually, anybody that is selling something for profit is an entrepreneur. So I might even argue that every single person that is employed is an entrepreneur.
Yes.
You're selling your time.
Yes.
You're selling your expertise.
Yes. I actually want to pause on that, because I think that that is such an important perspective, is that a lot of people employed don't see themselves as business people and don't value the time that they're selling. And so they almost feel as if they owe the business
100%
for the time, as if they're not working for the money that they're making at the end of the month. Which is weird, right?
Right.
And I suppose the thing is, the only difference, or maybe what causes that, is the fact that that paycheck is guaranteed on such and such a day.
Is it though? There's a false fallacy, or a fallacy, or a false hope that it's guaranteed.
Because it's not.
Retrenchments. It isn't really. It isn't really.
You could get fired. The business could go down.
100%. And I think that's one of the things that always kind of stood out in my mind for why I would never want to be employed by somebody else in that way, right? I don't like the idea that somebody else sees more of the road than I do.
Yes.
I want to know when we're going to crash. I want to be the first one to know. I don't want to be getting told after the fact, actually, this has been coming 6 months down the line, because that's usually the case. Like, a business doesn't just go under. There are signs, you know, there's building blocks. We made a loss this month and a loss next month, and there's no new business coming in. And somebody that is close enough to the front seat is seeing that. I want to be that person.
Yeah.
I don't want to be the guy sitting in the back seat thinking, okay, my paycheck is coming, I'm just waiting for the 25th. And then the 25th comes and we're being called into a meeting and being told, ish, yeah, this month, hey, we can pay you half. That for me, and I think I'm too much of a control freak for that.
That I agree. I know how much of a control freak you are, my friend. And you want to be in control all the time. And so I think that is fascinating, because, well, not even fascinating, but true for what I have seen in really good entrepreneurs. And when I say now, let's reframe that to say anybody who's selling something, including the people who are employed who sell their time.
100%.
The people who are very clear that I sell something and get paid for it, whether employed or not, have a desperate need to control their freedom. Right. So even somebody who's selling their time, I know the difference between an employed person that closes their laptop at 4 and the person who makes themselves busy until 10, 11 at night, for whatever reason, we don't know. But that's because they don't understand the value of their time.
100%.
Most of the time, to be like, but if it can be done tomorrow in the hours for which you get paid, do it tomorrow. Like, what is that?
Yeah, and it's completely the wrong way of looking at it, because then you need to be asking yourself, why are you even in that position in the first place? I mean, if it doesn't inspire you enough for you to actually want to commit the time you want to commit to it. And I guess this is the other thing, right, is the difficulty with being employed by someone, in as much as you're an entrepreneur, being an employee, ultimately, the way in which the job environment is structured is that your employer tends to view the time they are paying you for, in as much as that's the time that you're selling, right? Mm-hmm. In a typical organization, you then get obligated to be sitting behind this desk from 8 o'clock until 4 o'clock if that is the 8 hours that the employer views themselves to be paying you for. It's very few companies where people are actually able to adjust their thinking to say, actually, I'm not paying a bill for time. I'm paying Mbeo for a particular set of skills.
And outcomes.
What skills do I want from Mbeo, and what outcomes is it that I want from her?
And if she can do them in 3 hours,
happiness.
Great, I'm still going to pay her for the outcomes. 100%.
Happiness. You don't get that often.
No.
And I think my challenge when I was still employed was exactly that, is that I never felt like organizations, I think organizations have changed a lot since then. Of course, I haven't worked since, since I was 23. So what does that 26 years ago? No, 23 years ago? Yeah, something along those lines. So I can't keep track. It's been a long time, basically.
Since you've worked for somebody.
100%.
I love that for you. I really love it for you, because having been somebody who's all those 23 years that you've worked for yourself, I've worked for somebody else.
Fair.
By all intents and purposes,
fair,
right?
Fair.
And so exactly what you're talking about, you're even making some light bulbs go off for me around how many of those 23 years I spent unaware of my power, unaware of the fact that, you're selling something that is being bought.
100%.
And if you look at it that way and you are able to negotiate outcomes, because actually that's the thing. It's like, you know, the people who do that in organizations are often seen, oh, the business really likes this person, or they're somebody's pet or whatever it may. But actually, they're just people who are very clear. These are the terms that I'm going to negotiate 100%. For the outcomes that I'm going to give you. And this is how much I'd like to get paid. And this is how much leave I'd like to get. I mean, I remember
and when this is the number of hours I'd actually even like to be here. Like,
exactly.
Guys, as long as you're getting the outcomes, do you literally need to physically see me sitting at my desk playing Tetris? Because that's in essence what I'm going to end up doing.
Please, people really need to change their minds. And we've got lots of people who are running businesses that listen to this, that actually they need to realize that. What outcomes do you want from your people? And get the outcomes that you want at the standard that you want for what you're paying. And that's it.
Completely. So understandably, there are going to be some positions that require a person to be in a office type of environment, right?
Yes, need to be in front of the actual tools.
Completely, completely. Mm. But I think to a large extent, even those people, I mean, I'll take my accounting team as an example in my office. I generally have the conversation with them that says, okay, so the three of you or five of you work together. Right. So for you, it's important for you guys to be able to see each other, because some of the things that you need, you actually bounce off each other. But if the five of you can find a way to do this from somewhere else, hey, be my guest. Like, knock yourselves out, as long as at the end of each day, the outcomes that you need to produce are there. I could care less where you work from. Really, exactly. I could care less. As a result, I don't even have an office anymore. Like, I don't go to the office. I gave up my office before COVID. And I think my office, what used to be my office space, has now been turned into like a boardroom and like an open plan kind of space. And I think this is another thing just to touch on, is that what I love that COVID brought in was it forced us to kind of open up our thinking around exactly that. What is the best use of my time? In order to deliver the outcomes that I need to deliver? Is it for me to sit in traffic for 1 hour trying to get to the office and then to then sit in another 1 hour meeting when I could do that online? Does it actually make sense? Am I still able to give the same level of outcomes? Yes, fair enough. There is definitely face-to-face is necessary at some point. However, the ability for us to use our time more effectively really, really, for me, has been the most useful thing. I love the fact that now, and for me, by the way, you know, just to add to that, I think everybody's most expensive commodity is time.
Yes.
It is the one commodity.
Every single human being.
Every single human being.
It's the one thing we're all running out of.
100%. And we cannot make more of. I don't care how much money you've made. You literally cannot make more time.
And so that brings me back then to my original question about, because it is something, you know, when I was struggling last year to leave my job and to really consider exactly what we're talking about now.
Yeah.
How do I want to spend my time?
100%.
What is, you know, I spoke about it in the first episode that I did on this podcast about the fact that I lost a year with my kids.
Wow.
In effect.
And you're never going to get it back.
And I'm never going to get it back. But I lost a year with my kids. Like, I was leaving before they woke up. I was coming back after they'd gone to sleep. On weekends, I was exhausted. So I was either sleeping or working or thinking about work, even if I was with them, right? And so for me, it is that, considering that that is such an important commodity that everybody has and everybody's running out of, how do you... And I know that you found a rhythm in your business now where that is possible, but thinking about getting to that point, how do you find a balance or work around your time to be able to give as much to your kids as you do?
I mean, I don't think it was always there.
Yes, and that's why I say I know it wasn't always there.
I mean,
you worked towards it and you made some decisions.
Yeah, completely. I think although if I think back, I've always been conscious of time as a commodity. And I completely blame my dad, who I'll probably speak a lot more about, because I think he's probably like the biggest kind of overarching mentor influencer in my life, if you want to call it that. I think I must have been about 13 and my dad was about 40 or 38. He started talking about him dying a lot, like a lot, to the point where it got scary, where every day he would walk in and say, you know, tomorrow might be my last day, like that kind of.
And when you're 12, you've got no concept of like 40.
No.
You couldn't say to him, no, man, you're still young, man. To you, he's your dad and he's older.
Like, I literally started getting terrified. And I think over time, what it made me realize is the fact that he was just driving the point home of any day could be your last day. Mm. So make sure that in every single thing that you do, in every single day, you're doing it, number one, to the best of your ability, and number two, in a way that understands that today could be the last day.
Mm.
So from a young age, I think the concept of taking it day by day has been very overreaching in my head. So kind of then fast forward, I think I worked for about 3 years, and then I remember thinking to myself, okay, and I want to go into business. And I was conscious of the fact that business is going to take a lot of my time, like trying to set up a business. So I gave myself the year off, and I was like, okay, so for the next year, you're going to take a gap year, cashed in my pension, and I just partied for a year, literally, just did nothing. Cause, and I remember in that year thinking to myself, this is probably the last time in your life you're ever going to be this young, this healthy, and be able to do the things you're doing and take a year off and not have to work. So I put aside money, paid myself a little salary, and literally gave myself a year off because I was like, okay, going forward, this is probably never going to happen again.
That is so phenomenal, Lebo, because...
Did I never tell you the story?
You probably have, but I mean, like, how many stories do we have? Millions between each other. And I think sometimes you're telling the story not in the context of what we're discussing now, right? I think maybe I had made my own assumptions about why you were so resilient and why you literally are. Like, if I know that if I just need to hear one day at a time, one foot in front of the other, you're the person that I call.
Yeah.
Because you're very quick to kind of be like, what can you do today? That's the only thing that you need to figure
100%.
Out. What can you do today? And then just take it one day at a time.
Because that's all you have.
Because that's all you have. That's as much runway as you know that you have.
Completely. Because even right? by the end of today, you might not be here.
And I think, I suppose I had never connected it to that lesson that your dad told you, that you have told me before. But I've never connected it to the fact that that's what can make you make a decision like, okay, I'm making a decision that potentially, if I get it, I'm going to be so busy, I don't get to party. So you know what? I'm going to party and I'm going to cash in my pension and I'm going to... All the things that somebody says don't do.
Oh, no, completely.
Levels like we're doing exactly...
We're doing them now. Now. What if next week doesn't
I'm
come?
I'm cashing in my pension because people will be like, no, leave your pension. You don't know what's going to happen. No, I'm cashing it in. What are you going to do? I'm going to party for a whole year. For a whole year. Why? Because the decision that I've made to go into business means I might not be able to do that for a long time. So
I'm going to do it now.
I'm doing it now.
Yeah.
You know.
Why put it off till later?
Why put it off till later? You know, and I remember a story that, not a story, let me just say a moment that happened between us. And you were going through a tough time in business. And like any business, there was just a time when it was like, oh, the numbers are overwhelming. Mm-hmm. I have got a lot of debt. I've got this going on. And we go out for lunch and you walk in with a bag with a... let me say, not so an expensive dress in the back. And I was like, Chomi Kante, just yesterday were you not complaining to me, Hore, hey, and I remember you just looked at me and you said, Mbeo, the cost of this dress is not going to make a scratch to the debt that I have, right? And you know what? I'm going to put on this dress and it's going to make me feel good tomorrow. Right?
And but the debt will still be there.
The debt is still going to be there.
Yeah.
And it's not going to make a dent. And I remember that being the first time that I was like, your brain is wired differently to most people I know, right? Your brain is wired differently to how you perceive threat, how you perceive opportunity. It's just wired differently. So maybe you can talk to me a little bit about how your dad as a mentor has allowed that wiring of your brain, because I think it really can give us all, even as parents, whether employed or not, because now we've already settled. You are also an entrepreneur, Mr. Employee.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
I think it would be a good insight for our listeners in terms of what to be aware of with your kids and how you can help wire their brain for resilience.
Yeah. I think the one thing that was hardwired into all of us really was a sense of you cannot fail. My dad always used to say to us, you're second to none. And what he meant by that is nobody else like you. You are unique. There is literally nobody else can do what you do. So lean in on that and based on that, have a such a burning feeling that, you know what, today might not be my day, but Shem, it's not going to be like this forever. Like, I I've always had that. Like, it's something, even in the heights of all the difficulties, even when the business was not doing well, there was never a time where I could look at myself and go, ish, yeah, actually, let me just the end. Like, there was never ever that sense. It was
it was never the end. Tough time, but it was never the
100%.
End.
100%. And it was even if this portion, so let's just say, even if this business that I thought was going to work is now not going to work, okay, well, screw
we
it. This
another
one.
Business.
Start another one. It's okay. Like, we keep it moving. Because my dad always used to say to us from his, I remember I was the only one at home. And, In hindsight, you know, I was relaying the story to somebody and saying, my dad used to kind of cover things as lessons when it actually turned out he was broke. But
but you know what?
No, completely. So I begged to go to a very expensive boarding school that my sister was at the time in KZN. And I begged and I begged and my dad eventually agreed. And I get to this boarding school and I'm like, no, I sit on, I'm not boarding school and me. This is not going to work. What do you mean I'm asleep at a certain time? Kana, you, by the way, I did say I raised myself. Yes. So now there's this person who dictates to me that sleep at 10, wake up at, do your homework at,
rest at this time.
Eat cookies at this time. I was like, oh, hell no. What do you mean I must finish my plate? So safe to say boarding school didn't work out for me. Anyway, I then get expelled after working really hard to get expelled. No, I put in a lot of effort to get expelled, Shem. I worked hard at it. It was intentional. Like, I did everything I could to get expelled. They were nice enough to keep me until the end of the year after the exams. And then they called my parents and they were like,
nonsense, yalo, na, please.
Una le reporto, everything is shapo, just tamayanglin. My parents said nothing. I thought, yes, I got away with it. Many years later, I find out actually my dad couldn't afford to pay that school fee.
So he was like, good shot,
he was
my
actually
girl.
Grateful. Did
good
he?
Shot.
No, Shem, he didn't say a word. Decided to cover it up as a lesson in, oh, when you can get yourself fired from a school, so you must find your own school. And that's pretty much what I did. So it's always been these lessons in like being forced to be resilient.
What has it taught you about how you wire your children for resilience?
The belief that it doesn't matter what happens, you will bounce back. I think I had it as my profile picture the other day, and it said something along the lines of, not to spoil the ending, but everything's going to be okay.
Yeah, like that.
And that's exactly it, is that, you know what? Today might not be the day when everything is okay, but just keep pushing. Just keep pushing. Because you literally don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, if I look at myself in terms of my own business, man, if you'd asked me 10 years ago that I'd be here now, a part of me would have been like, yeah, of course. But there would have been another voice inside of me going, really?
How?
Oh, okay. Oh. Because literally everything that has come along to unlock my business in the way that it did feels like it came out of the blue. It literally feels like it. When I speak to the people, they're like, no, we were watching you. No, we were seeing you. And I was like, I was just doing my thing. But I wasn't doing my thing with an intention of being noticed or being seen. I was doing my thing just battling to survive, just getting through the one day and the next day and the next day and the day after that and the day after that. I remember there was a time, I think probably the biggest crisis my business went through was around about the time that I got divorced and I lost my house, lost my cars, lost pretty much everything and had to move into this tiny little house. Luckily, my kids were really small. So literally anywhere I was, they were happy to be there.
Yes.
Even if we had moved into a mkuku and we'd shared a bed, they would have still been fine. Because even then, in my mind, I was very clear on the fact that this is not our end.
Yes.
This is not where we're going to end up. This is a temporary pause on the way to
it's
having
shit right now.
Yeah. On the way to having more than what we had. I think I remember even saying to you, at the house that I left when I divorced, we'd been watching the Mike Tyson fight in my cinema at the time.
Yes.
When I said to you, I'm actually leaving. Yes. Like, this house, the bank is taking it, the cars, everything is going. And I remember after that, you said to me, Pachomi, how are you? Are you going to be okay? And I said to you, I'm going to build an even bigger house than this.
Yes.
Maybe not tomorrow or next week, but like, I'm very clear in my head.
And my business will become
more
successful.
My business, 100%.
The value is only the beginning.
100%.
There's only up from here.
There's a friend of ours, Lebumo says, who always likes to. There's something that she said to me during that time of the divorce. And she said to me, the only way an arrow can go forward is for it to be pulled back.
Yeah.
And that always stood out in my mind because for every single time I've had to pull back, it's been such a much bigger projectile forward.
Yeah.
And there's been just so much more than going forward. So it's that kind of constant innate belief that, you know what? Better is coming. Better is coming. And but also not just the belief, but the act of working towards it, right?
Action, right? Because without the action, like, you can believe all you want. And we know, I mean, like, 100%. We've seen in our worlds, just generally, whether it can be family, it can be friends, it can be people who sit in their belief. In other words, dreamers with no action. Like, you have to back up that belief with action. Whatever it is, just do the thing. Do the thing.
The universe responds to actions, not thoughts. You can think it all you want, but if you're not physically doing something towards it, and by physically doing something is in the tiniest way possible. I remember at that time, the mountain of issues I had felt like, I used to imagine it like an elephant. And my one of my favorite adages is the only way to eat an elephant is one bite at a time, right? But I then took that even a step further, and I said to myself, one bite at a time. However, focus on just the bite you're taking in that moment. So the idea is, stand so close to the elephant that you are not seeing the proportion size of it. You're only seeing the bite that you need to focus on in that moment. Because the moment you see the totality of the elephant,
it's so overwhelming,
it makes you want to run. And I remember when I was telling my friends, you guys and stuff, about just the enormity of it all, you all used to look at me like, oh my God, she's not going to make it.
You're just like, oh my...
Wow. But for me, it was, I never looked at the enormity. I was like, okay, it's fine. I'm just going to stand as close to this elephant, take this bite, and then the next bite, and then the next bite, and then the next bite, and so on we will go. And before you know it, you've eaten a leg. And now you're looking at that leg going, oh my God, how the hell did I get through that? But here we are. And you now still have appetite to keep going. That for me is, it's really about breaking it down into bite-sized chunks. So it's the lessons that I then try to teach my kids in literally everything that they do. I have a saying in the house, we never lose, we only win or we learn. You go into something with an intention to get a particular outcome, and you don't get that outcome, that's fine. Are you better off for having done that thing? I mean,
have you learned something?
100%. You spoke about my daughter being in sports, and my son is now also. For me, sports has been...
Sports is such a gift. Please.
Man, it's
please let your children do sports. Listen. Encourage them to do a sport. They don't even have to be brilliant at it, but flip, it is such a gift.
My husband, fiance person, calls it the sports is the university of life. He says, on that arena or that court or whatever it is, all of life lessons will come at you all at once. And I'm seeing this live in the eyes of my 16-year-old who has, she's had the toxic colleagues, i.e. the toxic boss in a toxic coach, the misdirected admin, the disorganized organization, and literally disorganized organization. It's made to look like it's so organized, and
but
you are
not.
So desperate to get into it. And once you get into it, you're like, oh my soul, what is going on here? These people have got no clue what they're doing, but they expect a certain outcome. So we're expected to go to this tournament and win, but yet we're not being given the tools. We have a coach who's got no clue what he's doing. In fact, he hardly ever shows up, or she hardly ever shows up. We have a team manager who's never here, doesn't know what she's doing half of the time.
We have team members who are here by virtue of flip. Nepotism or whatever.
Somebody
so
knows
holding,
them.
Yeah, they're holding the team back. 100%. It is really the university
some team
of life.
Some team members show up half-heartedly. They couldn't be bothered. Some are there just for the vibes. And you're the serious one, which is my child in this case, who's serious. And she's in it. And she's like, I want to win. I want to win. But everything is pointing in the direction of, what do I do if my entire surrounding is not going in the same direction I want to go in? And that is something I could never teach her. Like, I always say to her, I cannot get on the court. I can support you in so many ways. I just cannot get on the court and play for you. I cannot deal with the coach for you. If the coach gives you dodgy instructions in the middle of a game and you're even looking at that game and going, this guy, does he know what the hell he's thinking about? I can't help you with that. Like, and that's literally what a job environment is like, right?
And so also that's life.
That's life.
It's 100%. Like, you know, as a parent, all 100%. You can do is you're able to be able to say to your daughter after a bad day, you know, is remind them that a bad day doesn't make a bad life. And what did you learn today? 100%. What did you learn about yourself today? I know how frustrating everything else was. And the same lesson that you just said now is even in life, under G, we can't play the game of life for you as parents. All we can do is, you know, rufa maele, some advice. We give you some lessons. We set you up as best as possible.
Completely.
Right? With the education or the sporting equipment or but we can't get onto the pitch.
We can't do it for you.
We literally can't live your life for you. It's not possible.
Completely, completely.
You know.
But Chomi, I mean, we ran away from the topic of time and I think as my kids have gotten older, I'm lucky that I went through the most difficult times of my business when they were younger.
Yes.
And hindsight is 20/20, right? When they were young, I thought they needed me a lot. Now that they're in their teens,
Can we talk about teenagers and how much they need us? Please.
Oh, Lord. Wow.
And actually, I feel like that is such an important thing because I feel like a lot of people feel like they can take the gas off a bit when people are teenagers because they can dress themselves, feed themselves, you know, if they had to get onto the school bus to go to school or catch a taxi or whatever, they could probably do it. But actually, teens,
man,
they need us so bad.
And it's intentional parenting at
teens, intentional parenting
with kids, with like preteens, let me call it even like young kids. It's feed them, put them to bed, create a routine, get them to school, kind of pay for a roof over their head. It's very kind of Maslow's hierarchy somewhere down at the bottom. The older they get, it starts to become so much more intentional. Every conversation feels like an opportunity to impart some sort of knowledge. It's you almost have to be so present for it because it's the conversations that come out of left field.
Yes.
That are
especially when they haven't been speaking for like 3 days.
Sure.
Not speaking to you, not speaking to anybody. They're just in their room, whatever.
Completely.
And then you have a glimmer. You know, like a glimmer, like somebody opened the blind just a little bit and they're talking to you. And in that moment, you can't lose that moment.
And in that moment, so they might even be talking about something that is completely unrelated. And it's also almost up to you to be the detective to see that, okay, where is her mind or his mind at in this moment? Like, what can I impart that could help in a particular direction? So if, for instance, if I'll say to my daughter, like, how are you feeling? And she's like, fine. I'm like, okay. She says fine, but let me just kind of replay what happened in the last couple of days. Okay, she got a test coming up. Is it the test? Okay, and I'm looking at her and I'm thinking, does she look stressed? Maybe. Okay, cool. That's option number one. Does she maybe have a boyfriend or a relationship that I don't know about and that person is stressing her? Okay, there's an option. Is it maybe bullying at school? Okay, but she's never mentioning. You're literally having to run through that in your head the entire time. So in that moment where she says to me, fine, I never leave it at fine. I'm like, have you got a test coming up? She's like, no. I'm like, okay, cool. So that's off the table. Are you hangry? No. Why are you asking me that? I'm like, okay, cool. There's the answer. We've got the answer. But you're almost having to kind of try and decipher what is going on to be able to probe a little bit deeper. Because the deeper you probe, the more you're then able to say, okay, how do I assist here? What is it that I can say or do that could actually be able to take this conversation a little bit further so I can try to understand this kid a bit better? It constantly feels like I'm terrified that if I don't keep pulling the string in and keep kind of delving into their minds, I'm going to lose out on what is such a small space of time to be able to impart what values and
foundational
things. 100%.
And I think as well, because I think parenting teenagers, and I can't believe I'm still going to go there again.
Tell me, what do you mean? You're still about to parent double digit people. Your people are still in single digits.
Right? Because the 23-year-old has gone through that part. But even now at 23, it's different. There's a different set of things. We are really at the I can't live your life for you stage. It truly is a guiding phase of life, right? But I remember teenagehood, and I remember how hard it was. And I think it was hard also because it becomes a mirror to yourself.
100%.
Especially when you see your child. Yeah, especially.
I mean, you don't have any daughters.
I don't have any daughters. All the boys, right? But when I say a mirror to yourself, is kind of their perfectionism as a boy is often a hidden perfectionism. You don't know how hard they're being on themselves because they can't be vulnerable about it. They can't cry. Whereas my 8-year-old now, if he doesn't get something right in his drum lesson, or he doesn't get something right in something that he's trying to draw, there are tears of frustration that say, I want to do really, really well. Mm. Whereas my teenage boy, if he wanted to do really well at something, or he was putting himself under pressure to achieve something, they were often silent needs, right?
Yeah.
That to your point, I had to like probe.
Drag it out of him. Yeah.
Drag out of you, right? And it becomes such a reflection as well of your own bad habits. So watching a child push themselves too hard makes you reflect on how your own perfectionism is not serving you.
Completely.
And so there are often times when I feel like when you are speaking to a teenager, when you're advising them, when you're trying to give them a perspective, you're often reparenting yourself.
Completely. I said to my daughter the other day, it was something I saw on Instagram. It said, I don't give you advice because I know more than you. It's because I've done dumber stuff than you.
1,000%.
So,
and we shall not go into all the dumb stuff that we've done. But enough for all the life lessons.
And I'm trying to improve through you.
Yes.
Especially with a 16-year-old girl. Oh my God, the amount of things I see reflected back at me.
Yes.
Oh, you know, sometimes she snaps at me. The other day, she snapped at me. I can't even remember what I had said to her. And she gave me passive aggressive.
Mm.
And I had to look at her and I was like, yeah, nah, that's you right there. Mm. That right there. I literally had to respond to her and I was like, your passive aggressive looks funny on you. Because it almost looked funny in that moment that, oh, is this what you do? Like, look at you.
Because you're like, that's me.
No, this is me. That's me. This is me right there. Mm. And I find myself so often having to sit back and go, you actually are not entitled to be angry at her.
Mm.
Because she's literally giving you back to you.
Mm.
What you are supposed to do is recognize that that's you. Start to work on it within yourself. Yes, of course, nobody expects you to be perfect, but start to work on it within yourself.
Mm.
But also give her that grace that you need to give yourself.
Yes. And that you expect other people to give you when 100%. You're being exactly like that, 100%. Right?
Yeah.
So I want to move to something else that I find very inspiring about you. And it's something that I feel like, oh, we really should instill in ourselves to begin with and in our kids is travel. You travel a lot and you travel often, right? And you go with the kids or you go alone or you go for business, but you travel a lot. It's right up there with your values of stuff. When I think about sons or daughters, you know, I often say that if there's one thing that I want my children to know is please use your 20s traveling, exploring, seeing other cultures, going to other places. The world is literally your oyster. And living in Johannesburg or Cape Town or Durban or whatever town you're in for your whole life predominantly is the most limiting thing you can do with the limited amount of time that you have.
And it goes
like,
back to
time,
right?
Don't worry about that car. Don't worry about that car, babes. Don't worry about the apartment. Don't worry about the designer clothes.
It goes back to time, right, friend? Once again, it's that overarching thing of I have so little time.
Mm-hmm.
What could I best spend my time doing?
Mm.
Spending my time in a Porsche or a Lamborghini or a, I don't know, whatever other fancy cars it is that people get attracted to.
Mm.
I guess that's fine for some people, but for me, that doesn't feel like the best use of my time.
Mm.
For me, expanding my horizons and being able to see the things that I used to read about when I was young. I mean, I think I'm also very conscious of the fact that when we were young, we didn't have passports.
Yes.
We didn't have Google.
We couldn't have.
Or the internet. Mm. Or all of these things. I remember having a set of encyclopedias. Remember back then?
Yes.
World Book was our thing. Yes. Encyclopedia Britannica.
Britannica. I still have the Britannicas in my house, imagine.
And I had these. There was like a children's encyclopedia, and it came in like 10 books. And in one of the books was, so it kind of divided itself in, one was like maths, and then they like made maths fun. And the other one was like geography, or two books was geography.
And history.
And the
as
one,
well.
And history, right? Mm. The history and geography books were my absolute favorite, because I remember the geography book, somewhere in there was something about cultures and about different festivals around the world. And so there was like Mardi Gras, there was the carnival that happens in Brazil, there was La Tomatina in Spain, there was, so all of those things. I remember seeing those, being as young as like 8-9 years old, thinking I'd love to go and experience
that.
I'd love to see that. And I remember being in my early 20s, and that was my bucket list. I had a bucket list of all the things I wanted to go and experience, and some
and
of those
to
things
to see in the world,
100%,
to see, to experience, to taste, to enjoy, to hear a different language. I feel like for me, that's like one of my favorite things, is being in another country and not being able to understand anyone around you. Frustrating as it might be, but just seeing how people live differently.
Seeing
architecture that doesn't exist in your country, because it just doesn't exist.
No, completely.
In your country, right?
Although I've traveled so much now, I'm having to challenge myself. I'm like, okay, I've kind of gotten to a stage where I'm like, okay,
where next?
I now want to see places that really challenge my thinking. Japan was always my favorite. I mean, I've been there twice now. Japan is always amazing for me, but it's almost like I've just come from there now. And the second time I went, watching the evolution of Japan also is pretty interesting. So, you know, Japan is having to take in a lot more immigrants now because their population is basically dying out,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And you're already starting to see some changes start to come through. So I was sitting on the bus, and I ended up talking to a Pakistani guy who's studying in Japan. Like 5-7 years ago when I first went there, none of that. Even applying for a visa to Japan 5-7 years ago was a lot harder than what it is now.
Today,
it's an e-visa. So already kind of going back to places and starting to see kind of the evolution of those places is also starting to become quite interesting.
And I feel like that's interesting, right? Is to be able to see history in action.
100%.
I mean, like, you know, my favorite place to travel is on the continent.
Yeah.
I love traveling on the continent.
I've done enough of that.
I love it so much. And it's not easy travel, but it is so fulfilling in just being able to see Africans doing what they like to do in their countries. I love that, you know. I also love hosting other people from the continent here, because it's like, you know, there's our thing. Namibia's got their thing. Ghana's got their thing. You know, Nigeria's got their thing.
To me,
and there's
do you
nothing...
realize growing up, we didn't even know these countries existed? Like, does it actually
not in a real way, especially because I think, let's talk about the continent. Is
100%.
That for me, it's like, and that's why I love traveling the continent, is because the history that we were taught in
completely,
school was,
that's what
all
I mean,
European.
100%.
Exactly.
And that's what I mean by saying these places didn't really exist in our minds.
Yes.
As a, like, if you were to close your eyes and say, I'd like to visit somewhere, Ghana wouldn't be the first place that popped into your mind, or Senegal. Hell, you've seen those podcasts where they go around asking people to name 5 countries in Africa.
Yes.
And how so many people aren't able to. And I can almost excuse that, because in our generation, we were not even taught. You had to actively go out looking
to actively
things.
Look for it.
Unless you were in a family where, you know, people went to exile or anything. But if you were a mainstream typical family, you went to school, you didn't actually know about what existed beyond, say, even Zimbabwe.
Yes.
Beyond SADC, it was the rest of Africa.
Exactly. Which is still my worst term in the world, South Africa and rest of Africa. I've luckily worked in multinationals where they, most of the other countries that they operate in are on the continent. Mm-hmm. It's where the love came from. And you're right. Had I not worked in those organizations, I wouldn't have had the exposure that I've had to the continent, and to be able to fall in love with it as much as I am in love with it Now, the first organization that I worked for, it was like kind of like you were the head of, I was head of marketing for South Africa and rest of Africa. And I used to hate that term so much, right? Because it becomes like such a mentality thing. We're like that even as South Africans. It's almost like you are separating yourselves from the rest of the continent. And oh my gosh, the amount that we can learn and the amount that you can see and how beautiful the people are and how good the food is. And
I remember going to Senegal for the first time.
And I love this continent so much.
I was just struck by the weirdest things. Like, I mean, you know, we underestimate the amount of the impact that apartheid had on our minds, right? Especially growing up. And I remember getting to Senegal and we were driving past the beach. And there was just people playing, black people playing on the beach. It sounds so weird, but it was the first thing that it stood out in my mind. I looked at these people and I was like, why does this not look normal to me? But it was almost in that moment that you kind of come to the realization that we were never exposed to those things.
Yes. Like, and that our exposure is so limited, 100%. Even to our own bigness and our own beauty and what is possible. That for us, you know, it's like going to a captain of industry event in Lagos, the first time that I went to Nigeria. And you're walking into this huge ballroom where, let's say, the equivalent is you're walking into Sandton Convention Center. It's captains of industry of all kinds, banking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously, if you're sitting in South Africa and they're calling up the CEO of what, the founder of what, chances are the founders, owners, whatever, are all white.
Right.
If there is a black CEO, he's probably a co-CEO.
Yeah.
And then you walk into this ballroom in Nigeria, and it's a captains of industry event, and there was not a single... Not one
white person.
White person. Not one.
The mere fact
and we're
that
talking billion-dollar industries
the mere
here.
Fact that was... you even noticed that, Chomi. Does that not tell you like how
your
mind
everything
is
that
structured?
It tells you everything that you need
you
to know.
You even noticed it.
Yes.
Like, it's not even something that would stand out necessarily for a Nigerian person walking in.
Absolutely.
But for you, that was the first thing that struck you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On a more frivolous note, it's like going to the botanical gardens in Singapore.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Beautiful gardens, right? And there was this dog walker person walking towards me. This is frivolous, but there was a dog walker person walking towards me. And none of those dogs barked, babes.
These Singaporean dogs, they're well trained. Oh, no.
None of them barked.
I get you.
They didn't know I was black. Show me. I was like, oh, well, ain't that a thing?
Listen.
So,
I know just black people playing on the beach when I went at dogs that don't bark.
That didn't bark. At me, all the other three black people that I was with, like, they were not moved. They did not see us. They are walking in the garden. I suppose the way that... That's how white people experience dogs at Delta Park.
Right. Just experience life in general. Like,
the dogs aren't just randomly barking at you.
They have to think about. Like,
you know?
Isn't it annoying that, like, before anything, the first thing that occurs to you is I'm black and I'm female? Man, it's frustratingly annoying.
It
like,
is.
And it's like no matter how hard you try not to see it, it's like the world keeps throwing it back at you. I can't remember where I was and I got asked the question of how do you survive a male-dominated industry being a black female? I'm like, oh my God, you know how hard I'm working to not see myself as a black female? Like, stop it. I ended up having to answer and say, but in what I do, I'm a supplier. I am not a black female supplier. I don't supply melanin, nor do I supply estrogen or uteri. You know, anything that is uniquely black and female is not what I'm in. I supply petroleum and being a petroleum supplier, it's irrelevant what gender or skin color I am. But geez, like nobody ever lets you forget it. As a result, we just walk through life going, I'm black and I'm female, I'm black and I'm female. And
it shouldn't be what you lead with. It is something that you need to be aware of, but it's not something that you lead with, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, like, if I had to ask you that question, and I hear you having been in the industry for so long, the fact that my industry is predominantly
white
and male becomes something that, for you, it's like a whatever, right? Because you've built the muscle, you've kind of surpassed that, and you've proven people wrong so many times that the rooms that you walk in, you don't see that at all. But I'm sure there has been experiences where there is a new vendor or a new client.
Oh, I get it all
who
the
haven't,
time.
Who haven't. But I suppose what I'm hearing you say is because I no longer lead with that, because I've never led with the fact that I'm black and I'm female, because I've never led with it, it's not something that I see tripping me up. People are going to annoy me because they're annoying me.
And they're going to try trip me up. I mean, there was a customer that I walked into, and a black guy actually on the other end of the table said to me, "Well, besides being black, what else can you offer us?"
Oh,
I remember looking at this guy going, and literally in that moment, I was like, "Shem, he's trying to cut me down to size. Shem, he doesn't know me. Oh, like, woo, you've got the wrong person.
You
like,
got the wrong person. Ooh,
I'm like, dance. Okay. I was like, me, you're trying to get me, you're riling me up so I can be emotional." And I said to him, "Yo, if I sold melanin, hey, like, I absolutely, firstly, I'd be really wealthy. Mm. But secondly, I'd also have a lot of competition. I mean, there's a lot of melanin on the continent." Mm. You could see the guy's face was almost like, huh? And I said to him, "Okay, so I don't sell melanin, so yeah, that's not going to help you." Mm. So I didn't walk into this meeting trying to sell you melanin. What I did walk in actually trying to sell you was on the service we supply. And then I just kind of ran with the meeting and spoke about the service. Mm. It's almost then created as a thing that's supposed to trip you up.
Yes.
Like, this is your biggest weakness. Mm. No, buddy. Actually, what you don't know is it's my biggest strength.
Strength, actually. Because being black and female.
Being black and female means, firstly, I've never been allowed to lead with emotion. Mm. Never. Mm. Because in no environment are my tears able to mean anything. My tears cannot be a weapon. Mm. In fact, my tears are a weakness. Mm. So I've learned over time that I must keep my emotions in check.
Regulated.
And what that has then also done is that it's completely killed whatever ego I may have had. Mm. Shem, what little ego I may have had is gone. Mm. So now I look at you sitting across the table and I'm like, you know, me, I'm just here to feed my kids. Mm. I could care less how you're trying to make me feel. I'm walking out of here with a deal.
Because I have a clear outcome.
I don't have space for the emotions. I don't have... So I've never, ever been in an environment where I'm allowed to lead with the fact that I'm black and I'm female, because being black and female is not a strength in a corporate environment, in any event. It's never...
You're going to have to find other strengths, darling.
It's not something that, right, in as much as, yes, we talk about equality and we talk about transformation, and it's still in those environments, the same people who we are looking to for support, so i.e. black males, i.e. other black females, that will be the ones that will go out of their way to make you feel even smaller. As a result, you then very quickly learn over time that don't lead with that.
Don't lead with that.
That is not your strength.
Do not lead with that.
You better figure out what it is you're here to sell. Yeah. In your skills, your abilities, and you better be better than everybody else at it. Mm. Because by the way, you're already coming in at a disadvantage.
100%. I mean, and I had a conversation with Alicia about this, about how actually the biggest thing you should ever do in life, in work, is to protect your competence and your confidence. Everything else is...
secondary. I mean, I say it to my daughter when she was 13. She got selected for a provincial team. And one of the coaches said to her, you're black. It's fine. I get it. There's quotas in sport, right? And she said to her, "You're black. You don't really need to work all that hard. You only need to play better than the other black girls." And she came and she told me this. I was livid.
Yeah.
I was like...
And the fact that we still need to deal with that kind of nonsense, our kids still are dealing with that kind of nonsense, blows my mind.
Friend, she came to me and I said to her, "What kind of rubbish is that?" And I said to her, "You will never, ever... compare yourself to anybody based on skin color. You will never. If a sport is what you want to play, you will take the best people that you know at that sport and you'll compare yourself to them. And you will keep them as a benchmark. I don't care what their skin color is. I don't care where they come from. Hell, if you want to compare yourself to somebody who's been playing for 20 years in the Netherlands, that is your benchmark, right? And that is the person that you look up to. You will never, ever look at yourself in this limited environment of saying, I'm black and therefore these
I
are just...
I only need to be better than other women. I only need to be better than other black people. No, how limiting is that?
In fact, even in my own industry, I never look at it as even just my industry. I look at it in totality and I say, what is it that we give? We don't just sell petroleum. We sell a service, right? If I was to compare that service to any other service... Because that's pretty much what you can do. I'm going to compare myself to a service that I think has gone above and beyond in servicing me. So in then servicing my client, that's what I'm going to compare myself to. I could care less what industry. I could care less white people, black people, orange people. I could, honestly, I could care less. Mm. And that for me speaks to always kind of driving for excellence. Mm. That constant desire to say, I want to be better than what I am. Mm. And the only way for me to be better is to go beyond just comparing myself to this narrow, narrow benchmark, to benchmarking myself against the best of the best to my knowledge, mm. and trying as hard as I can to get as close to that as I possibly can. Not financially, right? Mm. Because money is infinite. Money is, and numbers are infinite. Mm. It's just got nothing to do with the finances. Mm. It has to do with how do you keep redefining what best means to you? Mm. And that is, for me, the definition around which success is placed. Mm. I have this thing that I tell my kids around how when we were growing up, I turned out I was really good at sports. I didn't know. And I joined this government school, and it was what, Model C schools back mm. then. And I started doing athletics. And every single weekend, there's an athletics meet. And I come home with all these certificates and I give them to my dad. And my dad packs them away at the top of his cupboard, doesn't say a word. And I do this for months, probably by like month 4 or month 5. I eventually say to him, I'm like, you know, but I come home with all these certificates and all these medals and you never say anything. So he stops and he's like, okay, so you want me to say something? I'm like, yeah, please. He pulls out just one certificate and he's like, okay, gold certificate. You came first in the 100 meters. Mm. And he says to me, okay, so when you started running that race, what did you intend to come? Mm. And I say to him, first. And he says, so you want me to congratulate you for achieving that which you intended to achieve? Mm. That's not an achievement. Mm-hmm. That's just doing what it is that you planned to do. Mm. If you said to me you wanted to come second and you came first, mm. that's an achievement. Mm. And I try to instill that in my kids. It instills a sense of constant driving for excellence. Mm. And never ever comparing yourself then within a narrow band. Mm. So if I wanted to come first, my objective should be to break the record. Now that I know I'm capable of coming first, break the record, right? And then at some point, it gets to a point where I'm now needing to ask myself, if I've run out of objectives in this thing, should I still be doing it?
100%. Because that's an important question.
Then it means this is no longer challenging. Yeah. It's time to move on to the next
this
challenge.
This is no longer worth my time.
100%.
Worth my time. I really feel like when I was calling you to come on to this episode, I really wanted to talk to you a lot about, like, say, entrepreneurship and motherhood. And now I'm thinking about the fact that I might actually have to call this episode
time.
And
it really is
time
that.
Is finite.
No, to me, it
don't
is.
Don't waste it.
And live so intentionally. Mm. I mean, you know, I've got this thing, and it started recently. Every morning, I now wake up and I literally, I run through almost like the bite-sized chunks of my day. Mm. And I go, okay, number one, are my children safe? Okay, where are they? All right, cool, that's done. Mm. All right, next. And it's almost like breaking up my time in saying, how do I want to spend my day today? Mm. Yes, there's things I need to get done. There's things I have to do. There's work that I do. But even in that, I still want to break down those chunks. And then there's a question that I've started asking myself of saying, okay, I see all of these things you are doing for everybody else. What are you doing for you? Mm. And even if the time for me is, you know what, for the next hour, I want to sit and play a crossword on my phone. Mm. That's what I want to do.
And you do it for yourself too.
I'm doing it for myself too.
It gives you permission to be like, it's okay. Because exactly like you're saying, you're also comparing yourself to yourself. And you're kind of saying, what do I want today? You know, there are days when gym is part of the things that I want. And then there are other days where it's not.
No, completely. So if I've got 24 rand in my pocket, right? 8 rand of that I want to spend sleeping. Mm. And the other 16 rand I now need to decide, how am I going to spend that? Mm. If you try and picture it like that, I think we would all be a lot more intentional about how we spend our time and about how we use our time. I don't think a day goes by where I don't think about the fact that today could be the last. Mm. And not in a scary way, right?
No.
Because I don't know.
In a way that energizes you.
No, completely.
To
be intentional.
Minimize the things that do not add value to you. Maximize completely. The things that they completely. That do. Right?
Completely.
And how can you do that more and more and more every day, that eventually your days are filled predominantly with the things that you enjoy doing or that are going to give you the outcomes that you want.
And I love my job. I mean, I enjoy my job. Yes, it has its stresses and not every day is fun. But even in the not so fun days, I still find myself looking back on those days and going, yeah, okay, that was gakma. I was all right. But yeah, you know, even in the gakma, there's a learning in there, you know? And the learnings is also for me a productive use of my day. So if I spend 4 rand of that or 4 rand of my 24 rand on those productive things in that specific day. Fabulous.
It's a win.
It's 100% a win.
It's a win. Lebo, I couldn't have asked for a better session. And I think that that is a great way to wrap it up. So, you know, I had some rapid fire questions for you, which I'm not going to ask you because I think you've answered a lot of them. And I love that for me. But there
is one I took notes of.
There is one that I do want to ask you because I feel like that's not a question I've asked you before and an answer that I don't know, which for some of them, maybe I would. Maybe I'll ask you the questions that I don't know the answers to.
Okay.
Because that would be great. Which is, if you could instantly master a new skill, what would it be?
When I saw this question, it circled around my mind for a long time. And you actually planted a seed because... I kept running around with it, and eventually I was like, I really love cooking. I thoroughly enjoy cooking. So,
and you do. You just don't do it a lot.
I don't do it a lot, but this is a skill I'd like to master. So I've actually started looking into taking up a chef's course. Yeah, like a home chef's course. So you planted a seed with that one.
I love that.
Yay, winning. So that's the plan as soon as I'm done renovating.
Finish that before you kill people. Do that. If your life was a movie, what would the title be?
I tried to think of a very short title, but instead I came up with a synopsis. And I saw this when
I love this. A whole synopsis. Where's my overachieving friends? The first synopsis again.
It was something I saw. I'll never forget this. I was working at Unilever and I must have been about 22 maybe. And I saw this on a card. And it stayed in my mind forever, to the extent that I actually went up Googling it and I found the exact card. And it said, life should not be a journey to the grave with the intention of arriving safely in an attractive and well-preserved body, but rather to skid in sideways, chocolate in one hand, wine in the other, body thoroughly used up, totally worn out and screaming, woohoo, what a ride. That is absolutely my life.
This is how
this podcast has ended up being about time. Is because even within that, it just talks about living intentionally and about using every single minute that you can directed in the way you would want to live your life.
I love it. Thank you so much, Lebo. I love you so much, my friend. You're such a blessing in my world. It's such a gift to me to be able to have somebody around you in my life to bounce stuff on, to talk to enjoy the spontaneity of life with. I'm so grateful, honestly, that
I'm grateful for you too, friend. I mean, you inspire me a lot as a boy mom. I mean, I'm a boy and girl mom. And I feel like it's sometimes so hard to be a boy mom because we've never been little boys.
Yes.
And sometimes you feel so out of your depth when it comes to being a boy mom because you literally have no experience to be able to tap into. And I'm always able to just pick up the phone and go, friend, you've got a boy much older than this. How do I talk to him? How do I get through to him? So you inspire me a lot too, friend, in so many different ways. Hell, just doing this podcast. I know, right?
Who would have thunk?
I was terrified when you quit your job. I was amongst one of those that I was like, Marampe
uetsang mar. My girl, that's what you said to me. You're like, and then when I, what are you doing?
I'm
done.
I know I'm wired differently, but I really don't expect my friends to be wired in the same way. I'm like, no, I was terrified for you, friend. But
I know.
But listen, I shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
I honestly shouldn't have been. Knowing you, knowing that you are actually quite a planner, and also you have the same resilience that I do. I know you... Yeah, it's very easy to project it to other people, but you have the same resilience, friend.
Thank you. I
mean, you don't talk. Yeah, you've directed the mic to other people. One day we're going to turn it on you. So
one day is one day, yeah, but it's not so today.
You can tell you say, us resilience. Yeah, how it's okay. We all know. Today. But yeah, Chomi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Lebo. That's my spirit animal, Lebo Mbete, a very good friend and a friend of Amandla. Thank you, Lebo.